Welcome to The Mental Breakdown, where we tackle all issues related to mental health, mental illness, parenting, schooling, relationships, and everything in between. While Drs. Bernie and Richard will provide the most up-to-date ideas and perspectives, the information provided in this podcast is not a substitute for medical care. Our goal here at The Mental Breakdown is to provide you with information to help you make your life the best it can be. So without further ado, here's Dr. Bernie and Dr. Richard. Welcome to episode 7 of The Mental Breakdown. I'm Dr. Bernie.
And I'm Dr. Richard.
And today, we're going to continue talking about some education issues. We're going to switch it up a little bit today. How are you feeling today, Dr. Marshall?
Doing well so far.
That's great. To it. Well, you know, over the past couple of weeks since we've been talking about and spending so much time doing some research and looking into all the educational things that we're talking about on the podcast, boy, we've received some pretty good feedback from folks. We've talked to some teachers, we've talked to some parents, and it's been fantastic hearing some feedback and hearing a little bit of praise that somebody's at least talking about this. And what was really interesting is I heard from a middle school teacher last week who was very excited about us talking about this because it has, most importantly, it has sparked some conversation at her school. She said that some of the teachers sit around talking about the podcast and talking about what we're writing, which is very exciting because that's what this is all about for us, is increasing conversation and hopefully eliciting some thought that maybe we need to reconsider how we're doing things and what we are really wanting in our education system. So today we're going to sort of switch format just a little bit. Over the past week, we've received a few emails from listeners, and so I'm going to read out the emails and we'll respond to them and talk about some of our thoughts about it and what we think is coming up and some of the consequences for some of the questions that they're asking. So let's start out with the first one. How does that sound, Dr.
Sounds
Richard?
Sounds good. Let's hear it.
All right. So here's our first email. It says, Dear Drs. Bernie and Richard, I'm a college student studying special education. You remember those days?
I remember.
I have enjoyed your podcasts over the past few weeks that focus on education reform. I'm finding some discrepancy in what I'm reading about how education was pre-Nickleby, which is No Child Left Behind, and what it has turned into since its authorization. Can you talk a little more about what was broken and needed to be fixed by Nickleby? What is not working? Thanks for all you do, and I look forward to your next podcast. Signed, Kendra. Well, thanks, Kendra, for sending in that email. Those are great questions because, you know, the idea of education reform is to presumably fix something that was seen as broken. So what was broken?
You know, the interesting word there is when she talks about educational reform. And when we talk about reforming education, all of the reformers all begin their discussion by the public education system is broken. But I'm not sure that it is. I mean, and many educational experts are not sure that the public school system is broken. But even if it is, I think we begin with the question is what's not working? When we talk about educational reform as a solution, I think that the real question is what problem is the solution going to fix? Because until No Child Left Behind, which was authorized first in 2001, the American school system was actually doing better by almost every measurement we used, whether it was graduation rates, the number of minority students who were graduating and completing upper-level high school courses, all the measures. There's a test called the National Assessment of Educational Progress. Those scores were rising. So almost every measure we had was, they were all rising until No Child Left Behind was implemented in 2001, and that began to change.
So we're not just talking about compared to where we are now and the way things were before No Child Left Behind. You're talking about even before No Child Left Behind, things were looking okay. Things were looking pretty good.
That's right. If you go back and look at all the test data, the graduation rates, the upward mobility of Black and Latino students. And by every measure, we were doing better in all respects. So the educational reformers, I think, and I think everybody agrees, that we're probably moving in the right direction. However, with the with the passage of No Child Left Behind in 2001, the entire reform movement took a very drastic turn in what I believe, and many educators believe, is the wrong direction.
Yeah, and as we talked over the last couple of podcasts, it seems as though a lot of that drive was this international comparisons, mm-hmm. international competitions about right. how our students compare to other students. Right. We weren't really looking at what we do here and how well we were doing here.
Correct.
We were looking at how we're doing compared to other places.
Right. That's sort of what was driving it. But I think there's also this notion that the public school system is broken. And, you know, people have this notion that public schools are these dens of iniquity or something. But when we talk about what needs to be improved, are we concerned about how our students are doing to students from other countries? That's one issue. Or are we concerned that there's something fundamentally wrong with the American public school? And when you talk about the American public school and what's wrong with it, are you talking about the way kids dress? Are you talking about the way they behave? Are you talking about what they're studying? Are you talking about graduation rates? What's broken? I think the first issue we have to decide is what's not working, and then what should we be fixing?
So to get to Kendra's question, was there anything broken back pre-2001 before Nickleby was written and passed into law? And I think that what we would have to say is nothing, at least as it relates to what Nickleby was trying to change.
Well, there has always been one fundamental problem in our educational system, and that's what's referred to as the achievement gap.
Right.
And for all time, from the very beginning, way back in the early 1800s, as we were just forming a country and just beginning a public school system, we have always had the achievement gap. And the achievement gap is the difference between students who come from privileged backgrounds who do well in school versus students who come from underprivileged backgrounds who don't do as well in school. That's called the achievement gap. That has always existed. It exists today. And I think the original reforms were designed mainly, one of the reasons for the original reforms was to try to close that achievement gap.
And this all fits together so well, you would think that we would plan it. But what you're saying, Dr. Richard, is that what was broken was not even addressed in Nickleby.
No.
In fact, the way that Nickleby was written, it would expand that achievement gap.
Right.
Because what will happen is the schools with more privileged students would do well, so they would get more funding mm-hmm. to continue to do well, while those students who serve the underprivileged, who we know because of the achievement gap that's been around for so long, continue to struggle. If they're not making the progress that they need to make, they're going to not get the additional fundings that could help them.
Right.
So it's, if anything, it has run the risk, and what we now see with 2020 hindsight, it has expanded that achievement gap.
Right, right. Because what No Child Left Behind did, the aspiration that no child would be left behind was good. Nobody disagreed with that. In fact, that was one of the early bipartisan bills. Senator Kennedy joined with President Bush in getting this bill through Congress. So the problem is that it required massive amounts of funding in order to raise the achievement of the underachieving students. That funding was never provided. So number one, this whole bill was underfunded. The second problem with No Child Left Behind, though, is it was based on I hesitate to even say this, but the main feature of No Child Left Behind was one of punishing underachieving schools by denying them funds. And the way that was done is that you tested all the students in a school, and schools whose students were doing well on the test got extra money as a reward, as an incentive, and schools that were underperforming didn't get that financial reward. So the schools that needed the resources ended up not getting them. And students who didn't pass the tests were essentially punished. They were either retained, or they were put into special classes, or they were denied graduation.
Yes. So, and Dr. Richard and I have a lot of opinions about the use of punishment and really its ineffectiveness in really accomplishing the goals that we have in education. And we echo much of the work of Dr. Ross Green, who also opposes the reward-punish type of paradigm as it relates to not just working with students, but the successfulness of schools and the education system. It also goes back to some of the work by Diane Ravitch, who talks about the way that education reform is affecting what we are teaching. We're not even teaching the things that we used to take pride in teaching. And because of that, students do not have the opportunities that they once had. We're taking the arts out of school. We're taking music out of school. We're taking physical education out of school. And we have to recognize that that has long-term implications, not just on students while they're in school, but students once they graduate. It's hard to ignore the correlation between our increasing problem with obesity and the decline of physical education and recess and things like that in schools. It is correlational, and we don't know that it's causal. But at the same time, it is an interesting fact that as we continue to see huge increases in poor health for our students, I read something the other day that suggests that current generation, the newest generation, is going to have a life expectancy that's shorter than its parents. Right. And that's the first time in history that that's ever happened. And it's all because of health-related concerns. So again, it's really difficult to imagine that there's no relationship between what we're focusing on in schools and what we're cutting from schools and some of these health-related implications that we're seeing in our children and young adults.
That's right. And that goes back to that issue that I think we talked about in our last podcast, podcast 6, is that you teach what you test.
Right.
We raised that issue before. And the curriculum, what we're teaching in schools, not only what subjects we're teaching, because as you just said, we're getting rid of some subjects altogether. So not only what we teach, but what we teach within a course. What are students learning in algebra? What are students learning in geometry? It's going to be what is on the test. So the curriculum is driven by the test content rather than the curriculum driving the test. The test is driving the curriculum.
Right. And when it comes to, and I can hear some of the arguments that folks will have, well, you know, to graduate high school, you have to take 2 PE or 2 physical education classes. Well, while that's true, let's not forget that you can take those physical education classes online. My daughter did that just because her schedule was full of other classes.
Yeah, kids are encouraged to do that. They're
right.
Encouraged to take PE online so they don't waste time during the school day.
Right.
Well, if they're taking it online, they're sitting in a chair.
Right. Okay. And you know, I remember her getting this almost a Fitbit type of device so that it can measure her exercising and things like that. Well, while I certainly made sure that she did her exercises and everything the way that she was supposed to, there is nothing to suggest that somebody else doesn't put on that device and use it to do the exercise. There's no guarantee. Unlike in a physical education class where the PE teacher sees the students and evaluates the student performing these different activities, there's no way to guarantee that in a online PE course. So sure, there are some ways that they're trying to keep it involved as far as you have to take a PE class. You know, moving and shifting those classes to an online sort of presentation really takes out all the meaningfulness of those classes. So, you know, there's lots of problems. And so, Kendra, going back to your question, what is not working? Well, today, in our current situation, there's a lot that's not working. There's a lot that's not working for teachers, and there's a lot that's not working for students, and there's a lot that's not working for parents who are trying to make sure that their kids get a good education so that they can do well into their lives and as they transition from childhood to adulthood.
But before we leave this topic, I want to stress again that when we say that our public schools are failing, I think it's important that whoever says that should specify in what way the public schools are failing. And then when they specify that, then we can come up with solutions for the problem. But just to say they're failing, so we're going to throw this solution at it, that's not a solution. It seems like what's happened in our country is someone decided that the public schools were failing, which they're not, but somebody decided they were failing, and the way to make them better was to hold everybody accountable. And that system failed, because that's what No Child Left Behind was designed to do. And everybody now acknowledges that No Child Left Behind has been a failure. And that's why Congress is in the process right now of rewriting No Child Left Behind, because in fact it failed. It's a 14-year experiment. It didn't work, and we need to move away from that. I can only hope that we have the courage to move away from it. And that begins with specifying what's wrong. What do we need to fix in our public schools? Let's be specific and let's address those issues, and let's come up with solutions that address those issues, not these other solutions that are sort of, well, let's see if this works or not.
Now, as you were just saying that, I know we need to move on to our next email. A thought just occurred to me, and I would love to hear your thoughts on it. Was the idea that the education system is broken based upon the fact that not everybody graduates? Do you think it was as simple as that, that, hey, we must be doing something wrong because 30% of our students don't graduate high school?
Well, I think that the high dropout rates, and they're frighteningly high dropout rates in our country, especially among minority students. I think the second problem is that even many students who were graduating were not reading or writing or doing math anywhere close to their grade level. And I think that was the second problem that we were trying to solve, is right. how do we assure that a student is, in fact, working at a high school level?
So right.
It's a legitimate question. It's a legitimate problem. But I'm not sure that testing everybody and holding teachers accountable and particularly blaming teachers for students' underachievement is the answer, is the solution to that problem.
Well, and I think that if we look at how No Child Left Behind was written, it was written under the delusion that everyone can read on grade level,
right,
and can achieve these standards at grade level, when we know purely statistically that that's right. not realistic.
I'm going to say this very slowly. No Child Left Behind was an aspirational goal. It would be the same thing as saying we're not going to have any more crime in 10 years. There are certain things that we can't control. We're not going to do away with crime. We're not going to do away with drugs. And we're not going to have every child working proficiently anytime. There are going to be children who struggle in school. What are we going to do about those children? And right now, we're not addressing those kids.
Right. Well, that's a great way to wrap up that. I hope, Kendra, I hope that answered your question. But if you have any other questions, please feel free to write in again. And we'll look forward to hearing from you. All right, so let's move on to the second email. Dear Drs. Bernie and Richard, I like it when it starts out like that. They all seem to start that way. I am the parent of a teacher in a regular elementary school. Although he is very smart, we did not know about some of the things that we needed to do to get him into a magnet or charter school. Our school system uses a waiting list, which is pretty common, and we did not sign up early enough to get him into a good middle school. So he will attend a regular middle school where I've heard that there are all kinds of problems. Once my son is in the middle school, what can I do if the education he is getting is not good enough, or if the school seems unsafe for him? Is there anything that I can do to protect his future? Thanks, thanks, Susan. That was from Susan. Thanks so much for that email. Wow, that's a tough question, because I think your options do begin to become very limited. Middle school is a tough time. Dr. Richard wrote a book with a middle school principal called Middle School Mind, and it talks about some of those relatively unique challenges of the middle schooler and what they are experiencing on a day-to-day basis. And middle school is tough. That was one grade level that I was never enthusiastic about teaching. Elementary school was okay. High school was okay. But I did not enjoy my time teaching in middle school. So Susan, so those are great questions. Is there anything that you can do to protect his future? What do you do if you feel that the school is not good enough or if the school seems unsafe? I think where we should start with that is really what you identified as the first major problem. And that is, the problem with the way our charter and magnet schools work. No one will disagree that charter and magnet schools, no one will disagree that they're good, they're doing relatively well at educating some students. They're doing a good job of providing resources and providing support for students. The problem is exactly what you're experiencing, Susan, and that is that there are limited spaces. And not only are there limited spaces, but those spaces are highly competitive. So if a student is not meeting certain expectations, then they can be asked to leave. And most importantly is that those schools tend to draw all the really strong students, leaving the other public schools at a deficit. So let's start out with that. Let's start out with talking about this problem that we have with the magnet and charter schools and what was in a portrayed in a great documentary called Waiting for Superman.
Right, yeah. Do we know where her name is Susan?
Yeah.
Do we know where she's from? Is she from Florida or something?
She's from Florida,
yes.
She's
from Florida, okay. But I think it's a problem in every state. The first question, I think she asked the question is, what can she do if she finds that her child is either in an underachieving school or maybe even a dangerous school? Unfortunately, Susan, there aren't many options. Some parents homeschool their children. They simply yank them out of the public school and homeschool them to keep them in a safe environment. Homeschooling children has some other disadvantages that we'll talk about another time. The second option is to send the child to a private school. Unfortunately, most of us don't have the resources to send our children to private schools. Those are really the only two options. And as Dr. Burney mentioned, the problem with these magnet and charter and private schools is that there aren't enough of them. One of the political buzzwords today is we should give parents choice of where they want to send their children. So the idea is, and that sounds great. If you're a politician and you're running for political office and you say to people, I think we should have a system where parents can send their children to the best schools that are available. That sounds great.
Choice is great.
Choice is great when you're in a political campaign and you're running for office. However, the only way choice will work is if you have enough places for the students who want to go to those schools. And right now, there isn't any place in the country where we have enough private, magnet, and charter schools for all the students who want to be in them. As a result, all of these high-achieving schools with high-achieving students have waiting lists. And in order to get in, you have to get into a lottery. And I think Susan mentioned that she didn't realize she had to do that, that you have to sign your kids out. You have to put your kids on a waiting list for a particular school.
Right.
Susan mentioned that in her email.
She did.
And she didn't realize that.
She didn't. And, you know, you and I have both had experiences talking with parents who put their children on the list for some of these schools when the child is only 2 years old. When the child is still a toddler, they're put on these lists. And you know, Dr. Richard, this is a silly question, I know, but it sounds like what you're saying is that through this choice process, actually, we don't have choice.
No, you really don't. I mean, there aren't enough places for choice.
Right. So if I choose, if I say, oh, well, I choose for my child to go to school A.
Right.
If school A doesn't have enough spaces.
And they don't.
I don't get my choice.
Because all of those high achieving schools have waiting lists. And so there aren't enough places for the kids who want them. So in fact, you can talk all you want about choice. But in fact, we don't have choice because there aren't places. There are no desks for those kids in those schools. And so some children who want to attend those schools are not able to simply because there aren't enough places. Again, if the politicians want choice, then provide enough high-achieving schools for all the students who want them. You mentioned the movie Waiting for Superman, and the end of that movie, I think, is one of the saddest episodes on film where that young girl and her family want her to go to this, I think it's a magnet school.
I think so.
But her number didn't come up, her lottery number didn't come up. And you can see the devastation in her because instead of being able to attend the magnet school where she would get a quality education, she had to go back to her zone school, her regular neighborhood school, where the educational achievement was lower. And it's devastating to watch her and her family's reaction, because this is a child
so sad.
Who probably would have done well, wasn't able to because she didn't win the education lottery. This is the United States, the richest country in the world, and we're doing education by lottery. I don't even have the words to express how I feel about that, that in the richest country in the world, some children get educated because their lottery number came up. There's something fundamentally wrong with that.
Not words we can put on the podcast.
Not words that I would put in this microphone.
But, you know, I think that the question then that a lot of parents have, and Susan, I think I'm going to add an extra question to your question is, why can't all schools be high-achieving schools? What prevents that? And what it comes down to, at least in part, are resources. We fail to give resources to some of the schools who need it most desperately. It's not, that would be, if I was writing it, I would underline not. It is not because the teachers don't care. It is not because the teachers don't have the ability. And it's really not because the students are inadequate. It's because we're not giving the resources that some of these schools need. I mean, if you walk into some of these, my kids go to a charter school because their numbers came up and they were able to go. The charter school was able to write a grant that afforded every student the opportunity to rent an iPad for the school year for $35. Okay? They each have their own iPad that they can bring home. They do all of their work on the iPad. They submit all of their homework on the iPad, which I think is awesome. That's wonderful. But then I talked to some of the teachers from other schools, and those students are fighting for 5 minutes of computer time because they don't have enough computers at the school for all the students to be able to get on and do some of the research they need for research papers and things like that. And then they're expecting them to do it at home. A lot of these students don't have the internet at home. I mean,
they don't have computers at home.
Right. We're working from this delusion of equality when right. It comes to this. Everyone does not have all of the resources available to them that they should have to have that equal opportunity, the equal education. So I think, Susan, adding to your question is, you know, why can't all schools be high-achieving schools? And it comes down to where we're setting our priorities, where we're setting our expectations, and where we're funneling some of the resources that schools would need to be successful.
The other thing I think that we should mention here is that when you develop a system, the kind of system that Susan's talking about, where she wanted to put her child into one of these choice schools, she wanted to exercise her choice by putting the child into a magnet or choice. She didn't know what she needed to do, but she knew she wanted to put her child in the best school possible. Most parents want that. However, we have these high-achieving schools because the highest-achieving students are populating. That's where they're going. So if you take a particular school district, let's say it has 100,000 students, the highest-achieving students, let's talk about the elementary school students, the highest-achieving elementary school students are going to find their ways into the magnet, charter, and private school system. Well, if you have a school of 400 students and 50 or 80 of them are taken out, 50 or 80 of the highest achieving students are taken out and put into a magnet school, that changes the composition of the neighborhood school.
Right.
Now you've taken all the students who are high achievers, who can pass the test, who set a positive example for the other students, they're now gone. So you're automatically creating a substandard school by removing the highest achieving students. That's the tragedy that's occurring in most school districts today.
Right. And, you know, I remember in graduate school, we had to, again, my degrees, like Dr. Richards' degree is in school psychology. One of the things we talked about was pedagogical practices that help promote school student learning and support. And one of the best teaching strategies is something called cooperative learning groups.
Right.
And what we do in cooperative learning groups is we take a good mixture of students and put them in small groups. So you have really strong students, mixed with average students, mixed with students who may be struggling a little bit. You put them all in the same group, and what you find is that everyone's ability within that group increases much better than if you put all the strong students together and all the weak students together. You'll see sort of discrepancies in improvement and achievement. When you create a heterogeneous mixture of students in one cooperative learning group, you find that all of the students excel. They all improve. And when you do exactly what Dr. Richard was just talking about, and you take all the strong students out of a school, that opportunity now is diminished. Now you have a situation where you don't have some of those really strong students that can help provide the support and create the path for some of the students who may be struggling to follow. You know, it's fascinating when you watch cooperative learning groups, because what you see is, you know, the teacher may provide some instruction on something and a student doesn't get it. But when another student teaches that student, so when you take the strong, academically strong student, and you put them in a group where now that student is teaching some of the other students, then you see the progress happening with the students who may be struggling a little bit. And as I've said dozens of times now, you know, that the old adage about those who can do, those who can't teach, everything we know about education proves that wrong. Because with these cooperative learning groups, what we see is that when the strong students are put in a situation where they have to, they're now trying to teach or they're trying to support their fellow students, it only increases even the strong students' understanding of the material, their awareness, and their utility of the information that they're learning. And again, we're just really taking away all of those opportunities when we funnel the really strong students out of their neighborhood schools. So, you know, that's a tough situation. As Richard said, you're limited in your opportunities, your options, once your son is in the regular education middle school. And as we said before, middle schools are tough. All middle schools are tough. There's very few that I've ever had the opportunity to work with where everything was smooth. You know, I would definitely encourage you to look at your son's middle school to see if there are any types of academies. You described your son as very smart. So, you know, looking at different academies, some middle schools are starting to do that, where you can run in particular tracks, and, you know, maybe it's a technology track or a medical track or something like that. That may help provide him some extra stimulation to perform and to do well there. But you're limited in your options, unfortunately.
Yeah, the only way you can really deal with this is, as I say, a private school is one option, homeschooling is another. But there is one other thing you can do. Your child is going to be in this middle school for about three years, and what I would recommend as a teacher, former teacher in a middle school, is that you get to know his teachers, you stay in touch with them, you make sure that he's doing all the best work that he can possibly do, and make the best of that situation. The other thing is to get him into extracurricular activities like scouting or sports, team sports in particular, where he's developing his social and emotional skills as well as his academic skills. Remember, he's only going to be there for 3 years, and if you stay involved and you stay close to the situation, you get him involved in the life of the school, his teachers will look out for him, the principal, the administration will look out for him, and then you can plan his high school career accordingly. What you don't want to let him do is you don't want him to falter. It sounds like he's had a pretty good elementary experience. What you don't want him to do is falter in middle school and then have to catch up in high school. So work closely with him and his teachers and keep him moving ahead as much as you can. That's what we would recommend if you have the time to do that. Just stay involved, get to know his teachers, stay close to the teachers, and work closely with him for this three-year period. He'll be ready for high school by then.
That's great advice. I guess it took us a little while to get there. We got off on that tangent of magnet church. Well, that's what it's like for us around here. We start talking about things.
Lots of tangents.
And man, there's so much to talk about. So let's jump into this last, which I think is my favorite email.
I'm happy about these emails, by the way. I want to encourage all of you who are listening to send us the emails, challenge us, ask questions. We'll give you whatever advice we can, but it's really good hearing from you.
And you know what we'll do also is if there's information, specific information in your emails that we're not sure about, we know principals, we know people who work in administration, we will get the answers for you and present them on the next podcast. So, all right, our last email. Dear Drs. Bernie and Richard, thanks so much for doing your podcast. You're welcome. I have really enjoyed listening to your views on education and mental health. I am the parent of a high school freshman. While she is a pretty good student with a 3.0 GPA, she is struggling in algebra. That I'm sure that there's a lot of people out there that can relate to that.
Right.
In fact, I am not certain that she will pass the class or the EOC, or the end of course exam. She is very gifted in reading and writing, but she has always struggled in math. I learned in one of your previous podcasts that in Florida, so I guess this mother is from Florida, to get a high school diploma, students have to pass algebra and geometry, including their respective EOCs. What if my daughter fails the EOC exam in algebra? What if she is never capable of passing these courses? Will she not be able to graduate from high school, meaning that she will not be able to go to college? This is a terrifying thought, as she is very smart, except in this one area. Thanks ahead of time for your guidance, Rebecca. Wow, Rebecca, thanks so much for that email.
Big problem.
Very big problem.
This algebra issue, you remember when we were in school, even when we were students, and we would always ask, why do I have to learn algebra? That was always one of the questions. I'm never going to use this. Why do I have to learn it? And, you know, for a lot of students, that's really true. If a student does not plan to go to college, there probably is no practical reason to learn Algebra 1 or Algebra 2. There just isn't. So in that respect, students who are not going to college, and that's probably about 60% of them, really don't need those subjects. Nevertheless, Algebra 1, plain geometry, and Algebra 2 are requirements to get a high school diploma. You must pass those courses,
right?
And you must pass the end of course exam for each one of those courses in order to get a high school diploma. Let's think about that for a minute. What you're saying is, if your child can't pass those three classes, your child is not going to get a regular high school diploma. Employment prospects are going to be pretty bleak without a high school diploma. So there are real important consequences here.
Long-term consequences.
Long-term, lifelong consequences for this decision. So who did this email come from?
Rebecca.
Rebecca, it's an excellent question and one that we need to talk about very carefully because there are lifelong consequences for the question that you're asking here.
Yes, so we did a little bit of digging into this. And I think that what we learned, and I talked about it before, is that, yes, you, as Dr. Richard just said, you have to pass Algebra 1, Geometry, and Algebra 2 classes. Now, to graduate, you have to pass the EOC for Algebra 1 and Geometry. You have to take the EOC for Algebra 2, but you don't necessarily have to pass that one for graduation. But you also have to take Biology and the Biology EOC and pass that. So we asked a couple teachers, you know, so what happens if a student doesn't pass the Algebra EOC? And what we learned is that, well, the short response was no high school diploma.
Right.
That was the short response, right? And then we got a little bit more detail that if a student in Florida doesn't pass the Algebra EOC, then they will be required to take the PERT, which is the Post-Secondary Education Readiness Test. Now, let's talk about what this means, because that was new information to us. And so we dug into that a little bit. And here's what we found on the Department of Education website and the frequently asked questions about as it relates to the PERT. What we found out is that every 11th grade student who does not make a 4 or 5 on the FCAT reading, now that will have to transition to the FSA for this year, but this was written when for last year with the FCAT. If a student doesn't score a 4 or 5 on FCAT reading or a 5 on FCAT math in their 10th grade year, they will be required to take the PERT in 11th grade. Now, the PERT is the entrance exam for Florida colleges, for the Florida college system. So if a student wanted to go to Polk Community College, Hillsborough Community College, any of the community colleges or state colleges, students would have to take the PERT in 11th grade if they didn't make the 4 or 5 on 10th grade FCAT reading or a 5 on FCAT, 10th grade FCAT math. If a student does not pass the PERT, now remember, the PERT is the entrance exam for Florida State colleges. It's, you know, it's not a high school class. It's not a high school test. It's a test for anybody who wants to get into college. You have to take this test. So every 11th grader who doesn't meet those expectations will have to take the PERT. If you don't pass the PERT in 11th grade, in 12th grade, you will have to take remedial classes that are aimed at preparing you for college readiness. If you don't pass that class, meaning that you're college ready, or if you don't pass the PERT the second time, you can only take it twice, if you don't pass it the second time, you do not graduate with a high school diploma.
Wait a minute. So in other words, you start taking these courses in 9th grade.
Correct.
Algebra 1.
Right.
And you have to pass the course, and you have to pass the end of course exam.
Correct.
And if you don't, then what happens? You have to take the PERT?
If you don't pass the end of course exam...
Yeah, let's say a 10th grader taking geometry fails the end of course exam. What does she have to do?
My understanding is that the student would have to, well, may have the opportunity to take it again.
To take the EOC again. Okay.
Now, if they pass the class, they don't have to take the class again.
Right.
But they can take the EOC again.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
So let's think about what that means. So you take algebra for all of 9th grade, you pass the class, but you fail the EOC.
Right.
That's not sufficient for graduation.
So that child right now can't graduate.
Right now won't be able to graduate.
Okay.
Next year, that student will go on to geometry. Because they passed the class, they'll go on to geometry.
Right.
At the end of that year, they will have the opportunity, or sometime within that year, they'll have the opportunity to take the algebra EOC again.
Okay.
They don't get to learn algebra again.
They don't take the course.
They don't take the course again.
Okay.
So, and this will be a question, and we're still digging into this. I'm not sure what the answer to this question is. But what support does the student have in preparation for taking the EOC the second time?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so if the student fails to pass the EOC, whether they take it once or twice or however many times, if they fail to pass the algebra EOC, when they get into 11th grade, they will have to take this PERT test.
Okay. So that would be the second step.
That would be the second step.
They have to pass the course, have to pass the EOC, then if they don't, then the PERT test.
Right.
In 11th grade.
Right.
Okay, go.
If they don't pass the PERT test, then they will have to take remedial classes to prepare them for college in 12th grade. If they don't pass those classes, or if they fail to pass the PERT test again, a second time, then they do not graduate with a standard high school diploma.
Okay. Question. If a student is not good in math,
Rebecca's
daughter, for example, she's not good at math. Let's say that she fails all three classes.
Mm-hmm.
That she doesn't pass Algebra 1, Plain Geometry, Algebra 2. What does her senior year look like? And then she takes the PERT, and she doesn't pass that.
If she doesn't pass Algebra, Rebecca, I'm sorry to say, if your daughter doesn't pass Algebra, doesn't pass Geometry, she probably will not pass the PERT.
Okay. And if she doesn't,
in 12th grade she'll take a remedial course.
Okay, so she gets a remedial course in those subjects as a senior in high school.
Right.
Okay.
If she doesn't pass the PERT the second time...
Oh, then she retakes the PERT.
Right.
Okay.
That's the way that that's the way it reads on the PERT website.
Right.
If you don't pass it the second time, no standard high school diploma. Now, she has a 3.0 GPA, which means that she does well in all of her other subjects.
Right.
Which means that she's doing well enough to overcome this deficiency in math, to maintain a decent GPA, despite the giftedness in these other subjects, she may not be able to get a high school diploma.
So this is a child who can't avoid math anymore. We used to be able to do that.
Right.
We'd get through it and not have to worry about it and go to college and take as little math as possible, which is what students are still doing. Now you can no longer do that. Because of these testing requirements, you can't just slide through.
That's
the
way.
You're going to get caught. And the consequence for not passing is, used to be, that you just wouldn't take a lot of math in college.
Right.
Now you can't get a high school diploma.
Right. That's the way that it reads online.
That's the troublesome part of this. That, again, if we go back to that punishment mentality. You know, if you want to hold kids accountable, you want to hold teachers accountable, I don't think anybody has any problem with that. I just don't like this punishment approach to this, that you're denying this kid a high school diploma, even though she has skills in all these other areas. It's just math that's a problem, and she can't get a high school diploma.
Right. It again goes back to that delusional belief of equality, that everybody is exactly the same. There was an article that was written and published in an education journal, I think it was last year, and what it said was, what we know, and Rebecca, this specifically applies to your daughter, is that what we know is that you're either born with an ability to do math, or you're not. And I think that a lot of you listening who maybe have some difficulty with math, you can appreciate that.
Right.
But because it told us, the research told us what we already know. There are some people who just don't think in math ways. And if you don't think in a math way, algebra is really tough. Now, I think in a math way. Algebra wasn't a challenge for me. My daughter thinks in a math way. Algebra wasn't tough for her. My brother did not think in a math way, and so algebra was a little bit more difficult for him. And we both have patients that we work with who clearly, and Rebecca, it sounds like your daughter, clearly does not think in a math way. Makes algebra very difficult. So, again, we know what the research says. We know what reality is. But yet we develop these policies that are going to make some students fail.
That's, I guess, where I'm stuck, is that, again, it's one of those aspirational goals. What we're saying is every high school student in the United States must pass these three classes. They must pass, even though we know that a percentage can't and will never be able to. We are setting it up as a requirement for graduation.
Right. At least in Florida.
Okay.
At least in Florida, that's the requirement.
So, Rebecca, I guess the short answer is you're going to have, your daughter's going to have to work her way through this assessment system.
Right.
And hopefully pass one of those tests, either, if not the end of course exam, then the PERT exam.
Right.
Otherwise, the sad truth is, the sad fact is that she's not going to get a regular high school diploma.
Right.
There's another part that's troublesome about this, and that is that there doesn't seem to be much in the way of getting her ready to pass these tests. I mean, we're not providing her remediation in 10th grade.
Right.
We're providing it in 12th grade at the end of her
right.
career. But that's a little ironic, I think. And
it's a little late.
I'm not sure what we're going to do about that. But she's going to get the remediation as she's about to leave high school instead of when she's in 9th or 10th grade, and it might do some good. We used to have summer school. There
right.
was a time when we had summer school, and summer school was the time when we rebuilt those skills or
right.
gave kids those skills that they didn't have. We did away with summer school because we don't have money. Again, richest country in the world, but we don't have money for summer school. But we have money for all this testing, and we wait until the end of a child's high school education to provide remediation.
Well, and I think it goes back to our mentality that, and that delusional mentality that everyone must go to college. So it's not remediation for high school. It's
right.
remediation for college. Well, she's
sure.
not in college yet.
And what if she doesn't plan to go to college? What about all the students who plan not to go to college? What about all the students who aren't good in math or English? And they're not going to go to college. They still have to take college requirements.
Right. It'll be...
I'm liable to start saying some of those words we're not allowed to say
no,
on air.
Don't do it.
Okay.
But it does make me sad to think what's going to happen to the graduation rates as this, because it can only drop. I mean, as we continue to raise the expectations for graduation, one of two things is going to happen. Either the actual student achievement is going to, what is actually expected of them to pass algebra is going to decrease just so that we can keep numbers up. I don't think we'll do that. Or the actual numbers of students who meet these expectations and get a standard diploma are going to drop. I think that's the only way that it's going to happen.
I guess the part that most troubles me is this punishment mentality that has crept into our educational system. We all acknowledge that there's a problem with kids not passing these courses. The first question is, is it necessary for all of them to pass these courses? You know, that goes back to when we first started this podcast. We said, are we asking the right questions? And maybe the question is, should we even have this as a requirement? Is it a reasonable, sensible, legitimate requirement that every student, regardless of their plans, regardless of their abilities, must pass these three courses in order to get a high school diploma? What does a high school diploma mean? That they can pass these four tests? Or is it larger than that?
Right, right.
And I guess that it's that we're going to punish you if you don't do this. That's the part that I find most troublesome. You're going to get punished if you don't do this. And you're going to get punished for the rest of your life because you're not going to have a high school diploma.
Right. And it creates feelings of inadequacy, lower self-esteem. You couldn't even get a high school diploma.
Right,
well,
right.
Good grief.
Is that what schools are about? Is to sort individuals out and say, you get to go on and you don't get to go on.
Right, right. Well, it looks like in a future podcast, we're going to have to spend more time talking about our impressions of the reward and punishment paradigm.
And Rebecca, I'd like to hear from you again as to how things are turning out. I'd like to come back to this issue sometime. So please let us know how things are working.
Yeah, okay? We're getting to the end of the year, so she'll be taking the EOC within the next couple of weeks.
Let
us know how it goes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, with that, I think that we're going to wrap up for this podcast. This was a lot of fun. I like responding to emails, so
yeah,
please
keep those emails coming.
Please send them in. Also, Dr. Richard and I are very new to a lot of this stuff, and I was reminded that one of the ways to help get the podcast out there and to get more people to listen to it and to sort of rise in the ranks on iTunes and everything is by people doing reviews and rating the podcast. So if you have the chance, if you liked what you hear, even if you don't like what you hear, we'd like to hear that too. If you could jump on iTunes and go to this podcast and do a quick rating or review and let us know what you think. In the very least, it could help us do a better job giving information to you. But in the best situation, it could help introduce other people to the podcast and hopefully create more of a discussion, more conversation as we move along. Anything else to add, Dr. Richard?
No, but there's a great deal left to be said. So I look forward to talking to all of you next week. Again, please try to send us an email, a tweet, any way you want to get in touch with us. And I'll look forward to talking to you guys next week.
That's right. Twitter, we're at Dr. Berney, DrBerney. We're on Facebook at The Mental Breakdown. So send us messages. We'll get them in any way that you choose to send them. Our website is thementalbreakdown.com. And we're looking forward to hearing more from you guys and doing the best we can to get you guys the information that you need. So until next time, I'm Dr. Berney.
I'm Dr. Richard.
And stay happy.
Thank you for listening to The Mental Breakdown. If you want more information, you can check out our website at www.pacflorida.com. The Mental Breakdown is sponsored in part by theledger.com, where you can read our weekly column in the Live section. Our podcasts are available for download on iTunes, and you can follow us on our YouTube channel and Facebook. We would love to hear from you, so feel free to send us messages either through our website or on Facebook. You can send us questions or topics you would like for us to address on future podcasts. Drs. Berney and Richard are available for workshops, so you can contact us for more information. Thank you for listening, and until next time, stay mentally healthy.